Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we brought Keith Raboy, general partner at the venture capital firm Founders Fund, on the podcast. Keith's an outspoken conservative, which is a particularly controversial place to be in a Silicon Valley that's increasingly divided over politics. Keith's been an executive at PayPal, LinkedIn, and Square, and he's invested in DoorDash, Stripe, and founded the real estate platform Opendoor.
Overall, it was a great discussion with Keith. We hit on a lot of different things. Started off with the vice presidential debate, where Keith actually was a former clerk on the federal judiciary, so we talk a lot about packing courts. He thinks it's a terrible political and policy decision, but for a lot of interesting reasons, so you're going to like that part. But then we move on to some more broader things, which are touching markets, Silicon Valley, the investor community, which is China, the relationship between the U.S. and China, the business community, how people in Silicon Valley are thinking about investing and having Chinese money in their own companies. We talked about why he opposes government antitrust efforts in the tech space. This, I actually think, is one of the best parts of the conversation because Keith, I mean, a lot of times we have people on, we have experts on, who give us like a policy reason why something would happen. Well, this is one of the people who would actually be affected by that policy. And frankly, it gives one of the best articulations that I've ever heard about antitrust, about the way that venture capital itself works, which I think is sorely missing amongst a lot of the policymaking community. And overall, I thought he gave a very good case for the tech industry to skeptics on the right. So look, I think we all fall in different parts of this conversation, but it's very worth your time to hear it from somebody on the other side.
Yeah, and a side note, Keith's husband, Jacob, actually came on The Realignment last August, this episode 49. We talked about tech in China. Jacob worked at Google, so there's a lot of really great stuff there. Go check that out after this. But before we dive in, as always, we have our realignment question this week. A reminder, if you drop us a 5-star rating with a question in the rating on Apple Podcasts or email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, we will answer your question on air. So this week's question is, if Republicans lose in a landslide next month, what shape do you think the next phase of the Republican Civil War will take? Who will be the biggest players? What do you think, Sagar? Ooh.
That's a really good question, Wheezy Man. So look, let's look to history. Last time there was a big loss, 2012, there was this something called the GOP autopsy that came out, kind of talked about why Mitt Romney lost. It had a bunch of prescriptions. A lot of those prescriptions were basically just be kind of like Paul Ryan, but more friendly towards immigrants. Well, this time around, I think the RNC is going to play a very big role. I think that you're going to have to look to the RNC chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel. If she doesn't stick around, whoever succeeds her will be a very pivotal and important figure, and they'll probably direct whatever the new strategy is in 2021, 2022. You also should look to the Senate. I mean, the Senate really has all the different players that we're talking about here. A guy like Tim Scott, who's probably a little bit more orthodox whenever it comes to economics, but he's a nice guy from the state of South Carolina. He's got a big profile. And of course, a lot of people look to him as the new face, so-called, of the old Republican Party. Somebody like former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, she's obviously posturing for a big run. She wants to claim the mantle kind of the old conservatism fusing with the new conservatism. You're also going to have people like Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, many of whom you've actually heard here on the podcast. They're going to play a big role. There's going to be outside players, the big groups, Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, but Wall Street Journal editorial page, of course. And you're going to have our friend Orrin Cass. I'm sure he's going to have something to say about it. So there's going to be a lot going on. We're definitely going to keep you updated kind of as that whole thing plays out. Who and what do you think is going to happen, Marshall?
Well, yeah, I want to talk more about the context that this is happening, because the Republican Civil War phrase, like obviously the questioner is read in, is referring to sort of the battles that you had after 2010 during the Obama presidency. So you had the Tea Party fighting against Republican House leadership, especially. So this was Speaker of the House John Boehner versus the Tea Party. It sort of went on for those sort of next 6 years, and that really defined the Trump era. But I think there won't even really be a Republican Civil War, frankly, if Biden goes on to win in a landslide. Because the key sort of thing here is that the immediate thing that I think most parts of the Republican Party will want to do is just move on. Move on in a couple of different ways. So if you're sort of more policy-centric, what you're thinking is, wow, we had this Trumpist aberration. We rejected our sort of like Reaganite Republican Party history, and it led to disaster. So let's go back to 2015. I don't even mean this in a bad faith way. They would say we had a winning formula. If the Republican Party of Marco Rubio in 15 or Jeb Bush had been in power, we wouldn't have lost this badly. So we'll take it back to that. So less immigration restrictionism, more hostility to entitlement programs, privatizing Social Security, that sort of more traditional free market approach. At the same time, though, there would be plenty of figures who define themselves as being very pro-Trump and very populist nationalist during the Trump era, who I think will pivot away from that focus because there not only won't be money there, but there won't be that much actual interest, and they will pivot to being anti-Joe Biden. So you're going to see a lot of people who spent the Trump era sort of acting like they were interested in changing the Republican Party. What instead they're going to talk about is how crazy it is that the Democrats are spending all of this money. I mean, this really was what happened during the Tea Party era. So that's what's going to sort of happen. There really will be no civil war, in my opinion, because at the end of the day, focusing on anti-Biden will enable people who are more interested in building up their profiles and getting Fox News hits. That'll be a huge win for them. And then if the people who wanted the actual policy to go back to the way it was, it'll be a win for them too. I mean, last part, what do you think about that part, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just smiling over here because I can see it so clearly. And Marshall just majorly subtweeted half of the people in Washington, D.C., just so you all understand that. And yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, to the extent that there's a civil war, look, there's going to be some interesting policy fights and all those things. And many of the people that I talked about, you know, there will be some tension. But overall, look, I was here for the Obama years. So was Marshall. We were born in this. There is no easier thing to do than to just be anti-Obama or anti-Biden. What will define the American right is going to look a lot more like the bullshit Benghazi hearings of 2013 than they are anything that we talk about here on this podcast. And I want to be straight up with you folks. I want to be very real about what it's going to look like because I think we owe you that. You know, I'm not going to say that there's going to be some grand realignment and some grand stuff is coming. The position of this pod has always been very simple. That the opportunity is there. We see trends in media, business, and politics shifting. It's the greatest opportunity of the century if you want to go out and grab it. If the Republicans don't want it, fine. That's up to them. And all indications currently are not that they do. Things could change. There's always going to be millions and millions of voters out there. But until they recognize that, that's on them.
That is an excellent, depressing/optimistic point to end on. So I'll read us out with a huge shout out to the Lincoln Network. As always, thank you for supporting this podcast. Guys, we are less than a month away from the Reboot 2020 conference. Speaking of this topic about the realignment of the right, Sagar, Rachel Bovert are going to be on a panel at Reboot right on November 6th, discussing this entire dynamic with the election results in mind. So be sure to check it out. And now on to the episode of Kiefer Boy. Keith, thank you for joining us on The Realignment.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to see you, Keith.
The first most obvious question is, did you watch the vice presidential debate last night?
I did indeed.
What did you think?
Well, I obviously Pence was more prepared than his boss. It was nice to see a Republican capable of articulating basic ideas with basic facts in a consistent, simple sentence. So coherence of a paragraph is nice sometimes to hear. There's a lot of interesting ideas, interesting data points that most Americans haven't been exposed to because the media filters them. So having the platform to be in front of live 40, 50, 60 million folks and express those ideas and expose people to facts that have been suppressed is a great opportunity for Pence and Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Keith, one thing I've been turning over my mind, and I'm curious what you think, because I mean, you've made a career out of disruption, is that so much of the Trump 2016 campaign was centered around the want for disruption. But in a strange way, I mean, definitely the chattering class they loved the normalcy of last night. And I have a sneaking suspicion, just based on some public polling I've reviewed, that a lot of other people too do. They want that too. What do you make of that normalcy dynamic?
Yeah, well, I think in 2016, people were willing to roll the dice. They were frustrated with how the elites were governing society in the United States, and they wanted to make a change. And they almost didn't care. It was like, I want to change everything because the world's going the wrong direction. After, you know, 3.5 years or 4 years of sound and fury, there's a mainstream movement in the United States across Republicans and Democrats, as well as independents, for a return to basic normalcy. I think a lot of people are just sick of the food fights. Like, if you think about it, it's been a very loud, chaotic time. And to some extent, people want to return to calmer, more peaceful conversations. And I think there's a lot of demand for that. So I think this civility and tone does matter. It doesn't mean that necessarily people want a policy change from the current administration or some sets of successful policies of the current administration, but they definitely don't want to deal with another 4 years of people throwing food at each other all day long, every day.
Yeah. And the most interesting unanswered question from this debate and the previous debate was Kamala and Joe Biden's lack of commitment to whether or not they would pack the court. Now, before you were, you know, building companies and serving as a venture capitalist, you actually were a lawyer and you actually clerked. So what do you think of A, the politics around the court packing debate, but B, just the idea of expanding the Supreme Court?
Well, the idea is ridiculous. I mean, it's legally possible and very clever. Obviously, it can be done by statute as opposed to constitutional amendment, which is why it's attractive to Democrats, at least some set of Democrats in the party. However, you know, FDR, who's the most successful president in American history, at least from an electoral standpoint, and with massive majorities in the Senate and the House, was completely unsuccessful at a similar idea. So the idea that, you know, I think Biden has very good political antenna. That's why he became the nominee at 78 years old. And he's avoided the worst impulses of the left. So he has no interest whatsoever in supporting an idea that, you know, basically threatened FDR's legitimacy. I mean, I remember being in high school, and one of the first things you learn about FDR is not about the Depression and not about World War II. It's about his Supreme Court packing idea. So if FDR didn't have success with this, you know, I don't think Joe Biden, with at best a thin majority in the Senate and perhaps a modest majority in the House, is unlikely to survive, you know, the withering assault of the American people once, you know, court packing becomes a topic, a mainstream topic again. So I think he's just going to do everything possible to be as silent as possible and avoid it at all, avoid commenting on all costs, because as soon as he, you know, sort of says no, then the left, of course, freaks out. And right now, everybody on the left is particularly thrilled, you know, with the idea of replacing Trump. And the worst thing he can do is create any, you know, dissonance there.
I'm glad you brought that back to history, but something I wonder about, and this is something we talk on the show a lot about, is the main difference between 1930s America and today's America is the level of sort of hyper-polarization and hyper-nationalized politics. So if you go back to those court packing schemes, some of the people who were so opposed to the court packing in the Democratic Party were those Southern conservative Democrats that in many ways, you know, you had a Democratic Party that was a much more different regional coalition, right? So Democrats in the Atlantic coast were different than Democrats in the South and the Southwest. But today it seems to me that Democrats from a national politics perspective are pretty uniform. Same thing for Republicans. So do you think that change would make any difference in the dynamics affecting Joe Biden's decision?
Well, if you look at the absolute majorities the Democrats had in both chambers, that was pretty critical, you know, to stopping the court packing scheme, as you put it. But I think the media, the elite opinion also, and the popular opinion also were deterrents. There's no way the Democrats have the kinds of majorities in the next 2 years that FDR had when he, you know, sort of pursued this idea. So I think that losing some coalition, it doesn't require as much of a loss of a coalition as FDR required to sort of lose energy around this topic. But I think there's already a few Democrats who've explicitly said that there's no way that they're going to support this. Think of the senator from West Virginia, Peters from Michigan, who's running in a tough re-election race, has said he explicitly would not support this. So you can already see a fair number of Democrats that are in the Senate that are off, you know, sort of the train. I don't think Senator Feinstein from California supports this.
Yeah, the part I always get back to is there were a lot of Republicans who said, no, it'll never happen. We'll never fill a seat. You know, you can roll the tape. And then they were like, well, circumstances actually changed. I can't help but think that, you know, these are all politics is national at this point. And, you know, in terms of the political dynamics, they could nuke the filibuster in the United States Senate. You only need 51 votes, right? And just given how the polls are right now, it's very within the realm of possibility. They could win like 53 seats in the Senate. You could still peel off a cinema and a mansion and get something like this done. I don't want to undercount the possibility.
I think there is some possibility.
Yeah.
Although, you know, to some extent, there's a way to retaliate as well. Like, right. So I don't think it's insane to believe that the Democrats have the votes to do this. I think it's unlikely that Biden wants to do it. But insofar as they do, there's likely to be future presidential elections, and there's certainly going to be, you know, additional senatorial elections. And, you know, the Republicans, once the precedent is set, can obviously, you know, expand the court as well.
Yeah.
It's a little easier to expand the court than contract the court. But fundamentally, once the genie's out of the bag, you know, it's a game that everybody can play. And it, if anything, you know, if history saw us anything over the last 40, 50 years, party swings, you know, are pretty frequent, actually. I think people thought that there was, you know, maybe a permanent Democratic majority in the House, and maybe they thought there's a slight Republican advantage in the Senate. But if you look at the last 50 years, or at the presidential level even, you don't see any of those trends being true. The Democrats have controlled the Senate almost as frequently as the Republicans have over the last 50 years. The Republicans, yeah, the president, the Republicans have slightly more frequently controlled the presidency. The House has been almost 50-50 since 1994. So fundamentally, you know, baking on the idea that any one party has control of the, you know, chambers of Congress and the presidency at the same time is not really a good idea. So anything you do, you know, you should expect to come back, you know, and perhaps haunt you in the future.
So Keith, I want to talk, speaking of politics, a little bit about your politics, especially in the context of Silicon Valley. And I the thing I appreciate most about how outspoken you are is that instead of sort of euphemizing the fact that you're a conservative with various terms like contrarian or libertarian or free thinker, I'm sure you could think of another euphemism. You just sort of say you're conservative. But on top of that, though, especially in 2016, you were pretty hostile to President Trump. While at the same time, as we sort of gone on, you've been very sort of behind a lot of the pivots when it comes to sort of China policy, a lot of sort of Middle Eastern things. So could you sort of expand? Because I think it's sort of an interesting dynamic, the way you've sort of approached these things.
Yeah, no, I'm fundamentally a conservative. I'm a principal conservative, which means I have certain principles I believe to, and that tends to align with the conservative label. I don't believe President Trump is either a conservative philosophically or certainly not a conservative personally. And, you know, mm-hmm. growing up in New York in the 1980s, it was very obvious, as Trump was a major figure in New York politics and New York entertainment and New York sports during time, that Trump is basically a sociopath. There's, you know, nothing about the administration is particularly surprising to anybody who's been exposed to Trump over the last 40 years. So, you know, as a person, I have no confidence and no conviction in his ability to do many things. And I think that is a key acid test for the president, is the personal characteristics of the president, not just their policy views. However, like any Republican administration, the administration has followed a lot of very smart ideas, because in fact, most left-wing ideas are wrong, somewhere between wrong and intellectually bankrupt. And so by pursuing a rightist agenda, he's got, you know, several things right. And the good news about being fairly immune from public criticism, from the media elites, and somewhat occasionally detached from reality, is he actually will do things that a lot of other Republicans are terrified from doing. So for example, you know, it's been in the Republican platform forever, at least since 1980, to move, you know, sort of the capital, or 1984, I think, to move the capital of Israel back to Jerusalem. And every Republican who's been elected president wimps out after they've been elected and doesn't do it, and Trump actually did it. Many Republican presidents have been terrified of confronting China for the last 40 years, and Trump has actually started the process of confronting China. And the longer we deterred, the more we deterred addressing the root cause of the problem with China, the worse we're off. The balance of forces has actually been shifted in their favor over the last 40 years. So every year that goes by, time has been a friend to China's power and influence. And the United States, to some extent, has been in decline relative to China. So the longer we deferred the problem, the worse leverage we had, the fewer levers we had at our disposal. So, you know, there's many things that he's done that are a mixed bag as well. Like, for example, his tax policy. I'm a fanatical fan of cutting taxes. I think the American tax regime is incredibly offensive, taxes in the United States are way too high. However, I would have cut personal taxes more and corporate taxes less. I wish he had cut the individual tax rates substantially. I think it would have helped him with his reelection campaign right now, giving more money to more normal families and less money to companies to some extent. But the politics of cutting corporate taxes were just easier because there was more bipartisan support for that. On healthcare, I think he's basically been a disaster. I think most Republicans have actually been a disaster on healthcare. We've had 10 plus years to sort of figure out a conservative free market solution to healthcare in the United States. And almost no Republican has proffered a reasonable alternative to socialized medicine. And so we're confronting versions of socialized medicine. It's like, are we 90% socialized, 80% socialized, 70%, 60%, instead of coming up with a solution. But then on the other, you know, then I can make lots of cases that, you know, the justices he's appointed are somewhere between good and great. The judges he's appointed to the appellate courts of the United States are almost without fail outstanding. The record's very mixed. On the FDA reform, he's been very strong. I think the FDA has been much more progressive. I think they made a lot of mistakes, obviously, with respect to COVID, but fundamentally, the regulatory friction in the United States for innovation in healthcare has been substantially reduced under the Trump administration. Under financial services, he's been very progressive. I think the idea of getting a bank charter for entrepreneurial startups and in supporting innovation is much more possible than it ever was under the Obama administration or would be under the Biden administration. So I think you have to go, you know, sort of topic by topic. And he gets somewhere between an A to an F, depending upon the topic.
Yeah, I think that's important to put it that way. And I think that's how a lot of people in the business community look at it as well. So, Keith, how are you looking at a prospective Biden administration? I mean, you've personally, I don't know what your personal feelings are about Biden. I'd love to hear them as well. I assume less objectionable. But many of the things that you just listed would be outright either reversed. And I think this is just more of a deeper understanding that we all here share of what regulatory regimes and the way governments actually work. So how are you thinking about that?
It's a great question. I think it depends a lot also on the composition of the U.S. Senate. So if Biden wins and there's a Republican Senate, I think it's very difficult for him to reverse many of these policies, but not all. If the Democrats were to control the Senate, even with 51 or so, maybe they need 53 votes to really enact an aggressive liberal agenda, then I think, you know, all the rules are up for grabs again. So it's impossible to determine that. I think there's an interesting question for a lot of Republican senatorial candidates in the next 2 weeks of whether they start basically saying, vote for me as a break on Biden. And, you know, that would probably save the Republicans somewhere between 2 and 3 seats, because I think there are a lot of people that are uncomfortable with the left-wing agenda of Kamala Harris, et cetera, but that are probably going to vote for Biden because they're just sick of Trump, truthfully, like personally. And I think senatorial candidates that run on the, you're a Republican, you're independent, but leaning Republican, I know you don't like Trump, but vote for me as a check on the power of the left, could actually, you know, pick up 2 to 5%, depending upon the state, and that would carry a few to victory. But it's very controversial. It's very complicated to do that. You know, no one wants to be the first one sort of abandoning the ship. They certainly know that Trump is capable of being very critical and putting them in the spotlight if they abandon the ship. But in the self-interest of a lot of Republican politicians running for Senate, either as challengers or incumbents, the idea of basically admitting that Biden's likely to win and that they can be an effective check on left-wing power would probably, you know, add to the Republican majority. But I don't know if anybody's going to have enough confidence and conviction to run those campaigns.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard because that sort of brings to mind the debate that a lot of senators had in 2016, because part of the issue here, though, is that just as sort of running in favor of sort of making that sort of anti-Biden pivot, I think would possibly harm base turnout. So there were a couple examples of 16 of you know, senators overperforming Trump, but Trump definitely sort of pushed up turnout. That's sort of, once again, the sort of problem they're sort of thinking about. I want to pivot a bit more towards the China conversation, especially in the context of Silicon Valley. Sagar and I were talking about it beforehand, and something we sort of noticed in a lot of your remarks is that, unlike a lot of people in Silicon Valley, you were particularly sort of aggressive on the China issue before it became quite as fashionable as it's become over the past few months, because now there really is this bipartisan consensus. So could you speak to the sort of dynamic that is driving what can be called that drove sycophancy towards China, both in places, you know, Netflix runs into this issue, Disney obviously runs into this issue with Mulan and the Uyghurs. So can you speak to this dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of people had either the desire or the actual reality of making money through China. China's a big market. It's 1.2 billion people. It's the second largest market, arguably, next to the United States. So lots of companies, and the larger, the more this is true, had desires of making money by selling, you know, goods and services into China. The problem is when you're making a lot of money in a country and the country is very strategic, they can threaten your ability to continue to produce cars, phones, sell whatever goods and services, movies, by economic leverage. We saw this most conspicuously about a year and a half ago with respect to the NBA. NBA, which, you know, players and owners can be extremely progressive in the United States and are very critical of, you know, conservatives, Republican policies, whatever. They're very happy protesting and when something's going wrong in the United States. But as soon as, you know, China starts suppressing Hong Kong, and some Americans recognize the threat to democracy and to free speech, every single NBA player and virtually every single NBA owner and executive was cowering in fear of China's retaliation using economic leverage, because they all make a lot of money through China and they want to make more money through China. I mean, it's the most embarrassing thing ever, is like the hypocritical nature of NBA players is, you know, off the charts, maybe the most hypocritical stances I've seen in my entire career. So fundamentally, China uses their economic leverage with movie producers. I mean, I think there's been several studies that have shown that there isn't a mainstream movie that has a Chinese villain that's been produced in the United States since like the early 90s, versus like compare and contrast to the archetypical, you know, archetype of a Russian villain. So, you know, China is incredibly strategic, very thoughtful about how to use different pieces of their leverage to get results they want. I think that was when sea change started in the American people's mind. I think Hong Kong and the NBA did actually cut through the clutter to a normal person sitting in the middle of America, where the threat posed by AI and a race with about AI with China was something Silicon Valley elites paid attention to and were concerned about, but was too esoteric for a normal person. But the Hong Kong protests definitely resonated with a lot of people. The hypocrisy of the NBA and other athletes resonated with the American people. And, you know, then there's these skirmishes with India and, you know, things that are impossible to ignore, the genocide that's being committed. Those are things that, you know, history has taught us that one ignores even small doses, and they, you know, come back a few years later in massive doses. So I think right now there's a comprehensive concern with China, but there's a lot of people who have a strong economic interest in suppressing this information. There's also a lot of people who are responsible for the failed policy of engagement. So the policy of engagement that we pursued for the last basically 50 years in the United States has been a complete adjunct failure. And there's a lot of people who recommended that strategy, who pursued that strategy, including Biden, who are just embarrassed by it. And so every time you talk about a threat posed by China, it indicts their entire political career and track record. So they have a lot of self-interest in suppressing this. So the combination of the two has really handicapped any American politician's ability to focus on the issue. As I said, one of the virtues of Trump is he's fairly immune from this. He doesn't care about the, you know, other people's self-interest. He doesn't care about the media's criticism of him. I mean, remember the violence of the attacks he confronted when he banned travel from China when, you know, when COVID was first becoming a world topic. He was accused of being racist and discriminatory, and you know, all the Democrats said he was insane. Turns out, if anything, he acted a little too late in banning travel from China. And part of the reason why he was late was his own internal bureaucracy was opposing him. The State Department, the Treasury Department, there were a lot of bureaucrats that actually slowed him down, whereas he really wanted to act and ban travel from China 2 to 3 weeks earlier. And with somewhat benefit of hindsight, it would have made a massive difference in the ability of COVID to be spread to the United States. So I think there's just a lot of people who are guilty here. There's the economic guilty, there's the politically guilty. But finally, the truth is getting out and you can't really stop it. So I saw this amazing poll yesterday on Twitter published by Ian Bremmer, who's like a mainstream Democratic sort of political foreign policy expert. And it showed the perception of China in every, you know, Western democracy, basically in free fall over the last year. So China's been so offensive and on so many different fronts that every country in the across the world that's basically democratic or Western has seen the popularity or confidence in China basically decreased by 2/3. So this is not a, you know, Trump thing. This is in Germany. This is in Korea. It's everywhere. So, you know, once I don't think that there's any way to sort of stop the attention. I mean, fortunately, we've been rebuilding the American military, particularly the Navy. China, you know, under the radar, had been really building out for the last decade a sophisticated Navy. And we've been neglecting ours under the Obama administration. And fortunately, now we're getting close to 350 ships again, which will allow us at least to respond somewhat successfully to China's aggressiveness, you know, in Asia. So things are getting better, at least at the political level and at the popular conscious level, but we're so far behind.
Yeah, and Keith, I think this is probably the thing that concerns me most is about the impact and like Chinese infiltration of the American business community. Of course, entertainment is the part where you see it, and I completely agree with you. It touches the soul of the average American. But that, you know, the AI stuff you were pointing out, you know, radically important. I was at that speech with Peter Thiel where he was talking about Google and China, and you know, I just for a recap for the audience, like that was when Peter Thiel really called Google out as not a patriotic company. And essentially, you know, was basically asked them to prove that they weren't infiltrated by the Chinese Communist Party's spy regime. One of the things I want to get from you is just for our policymaking audience is in the minds of the business community, is there a check now on these sorts of decisions like Disney cooperating with a literal, you know, a literal agency within China that you know, a literal agency in China that is tasked with administering concentration camps. I think that's probably done. But in terms of looking at the Chinese market and more, is there the trepidation that I think I would like to see in the American business community just from your perspective? What do you think?
There's starting to be some, you know, the Disney example being, you know, highlighting, I guess, the risks to CEOs who want to neglect the concentration camps and the policies. But on the other hand, if you read the front page of the New York Times is like, China's great. You know, there's all these great features of the China regime. The internet's, you know, suppressed in speech, but people are happy. So, you know, like fundamentally, the New York Times hasn't got the memo yet, but a lot of other American leaders are. And even a year or two ago, I would say, you know, Silicon Valley leaders have no affection for Trump. I mean, like virtually zero. Yeah. But his China policy and confronting China even a year or two ago, I'd say was running about 50-50 among my friends in Silicon Valley. So it's probably the most popular of all the Trump decisions and policies. Confronting China is the most popular, which doesn't say much, you know, it's compared to what, but like literally it was about 50-50 because people in Silicon Valley were very aware about the intellectual theft, you know, that's been going on for decades, certainly aware about the threat posed by AI, definitely about the infiltration of Chinese spies into various companies. So that stuff was very top of mind, even in Silicon Valley, even if it wasn't, you know, well understood outside Silicon Valley. So when Trump ran in, you know, 2016, he was very, very specific about the threat posed by China. There's some funny YouTube videos you can watch that sort of, you know, excerpt all of his China from all his speeches that are, you know, pretty compelling. there really was a sea change in Silicon Valley. Like I can't even think of the second most popular Trump policy in Silicon Valley because like nothing would get more than like maybe 10% support here. But the China policy is really at least 50-50.
Before we go into tech, I just want to, another interesting dynamic around you is just sort of I'd say your really frank, aggressive stance against sort of Saudi Arabia and the role that Saudi Arabia plays in sort of the funding ecosystem in Silicon Valley. But, you know, as we're talking about a lot of things that you've liked about the Trump administration, like cozying up to the Saudi regime has definitely been a decision they've sort of made, right? And that sort of broader Middle Eastern portfolio, especially to balance against Iran. So how do you think, so I realize on a personal level and an investment level, you've been skeptical and opposed to sort of like engaging with Saudi Arabia, but what do you think about the international relations, especially in the, you know, wake of Khashoggi and all of MBS and those sort of broader debates in the region?
Well, right. So obviously, Saudi Arabia has been a regime that's funded terrorists all across the globe, including, you know, killing Americans. It's been a regime that officially, still as of this day, prosecutes and persecutes Jewish people, gays, and discriminates explicitly by law against women. So I think it's just a non-starter for any conscientious American to do business with Saudi Arabia. I understand the geopolitical realities of the Middle East is complicated. It's been a long, it's been difficult for the American, you know, government to find allies anywhere in the Middle East. Although fortunately, one of the other benefits of the Trump administration is peace breaking out in the Middle East is a function of Trump taking a different approach to Middle Eastern policy. He basically took a first principles approach and said, like, look, we have one friend there. There's one democratically elected government in Israel, and we're going to support them. And we're not going to, you know, defer, and we're not going to be blackmailed by people who want to kill Israel and are refusing to accept the democratic legitimacy of Israel. And guess what? With enough consistency to that position and without, you know, sort of being willing to be blackmailed, eventually lots of countries and leaders in the Middle East are realizing that they should just recognize Israel. And so peace is basically breaking out now, some of it explicitly and, you know, unprecedented cooperation and agreements and, you know, air flights and all of the great, you know, developments we've seen over the last 6 months, and some implicitly. There's some stuff, you know, behind the scenes that isn't yet formally announced, but is likely to occur. Certainly if Trump's reelected in the first 6 months, you're going to see a lot of Middle Eastern regimes cooperating with Israel explicitly. I think some of them are waiting to see, you know, the election results before putting their necks, you know, a little bit more out on the limb. But we could see a year from today, if somehow Trump pulls off a reelection, almost complete, you know, peaceful coexistence in the Middle East, other than, you know, one or two sort of, you know, terror regimes. And that would be the most radical change in all of our foreign policy since, you know, basically the fall of the Soviet Union and the Berlin Wall, and probably the second most consequential foreign policy victory for the United States since 1945.
Yeah, Keith, here's something I'm curious about, since you're a conservative, and this is a debate that we have on the right all the time here in Washington, which is that, you said, you know, at the most popular, it's 50-50 on China. At a certain point, are you comfortable as a conservative supporting a government, you know, like the Commerce Department just being like, no, it's not going to happen. We cannot do business with Chinese firms in these particular areas of government, not just national security, but economic heart, you know, in terms of economic sectors, the way that we talked about steel and others, and maybe even extend it to places like Saudi Arabia based upon moral objections. What do you think?
Yeah, I fundamentally believe in there are roots to American foreign policy that are based on principle, not just free trade. So I believe as a default that free trade has been incredibly liberalizing for Americans. It's improved the standard of living in this country, and it's improved the standard of living everywhere. Like, I believe in comparative advantage. All of the things are taught in sort of Econ 101 are true. However, there are also other elements of life just beyond increasing your standard of living. So I think that trading those off is complex and without a doubt non-trivial. But just like we boycotted several things that because of what the Soviet Union used to do. I mean, for example, the Soviet Union used to really persecute Jewish people. And Congress passed and the president implemented several sanctions on the Soviet Union as a function of the way they were treating Jewish people. And I think that's a perfectly appropriate exercise of both legislative and executive power. And I think we need to treat China a lot closer to how we treated the Soviet Union. They're a hostile, authoritarian regime designed where they've made the internal decision that the American system is incompatible with their future growth and their future vision of the world. And they have actually, in some ways, they're more of a threat because they have a better economic engine behind them. Yeah, Soviet Union really didn't have any economic engine, had very limited natural resources. They had a lot of very smart people, like innovation around physics, you know, is still to this day impressive as hell. Like you can find papers written about math and physics from the 1960s in the Soviet Union, and they're better than anything written today anywhere else. So fundamentally, they had incredible talent of people, but no natural resources and a completely bankrupt economy. China has 1.2 billion people with an incredible work ethic, some natural resources, and in a really strong economy. Whether or not you believe the exact economic metrics that they, you know, they circulate, that may be a little bit of propaganda there, but the economy is very real. And so I actually think they have significantly greater potential threat to the United States than in many ways the Soviet Union did.
So for our last section, I want to get into all the fun tech stuff. So I think the first... And this is another way that your politics have been interesting. Like, obviously, like the tech community in Silicon Valley are sort of under ideological critique slash assault by sort of both directions. So if you're on the left, right, there's obviously the critique about monopoly power and the role of a sort of tech company sort of play there. So, you know, there were just sort of House antitrust hearings. There were hearings earlier in the summer. Like, what do you think that dynamic is going to turn into as we move into 2021?
Well, it is a function to some extent of elections, but let me start with first principles. The idea that there's these tech monopolies that are, you know, dominating society is just intellectually completely bankrupt and silly. So for example, I saw in the House report some argument that because of the power of Google, Apple, et cetera, there was a deterrence of innovation and venture investing. That is the most false statement I've read in my entire lifetime. So I've been a professional VC since 2013. This is the hottest venture capital market over the last 7 years in American history. So if there's, and this is all empirically validated, perfectly empirically provable. There's absolutely no deterrence of venture capital anywhere in America based upon Google, Apple, or any other large company. We're spending more money investing in more companies at a more frequent pace at higher valuations than at any time in American history. And the companies that are in the, and it's just period. It's unequivocal data. So the House is just lying to the American people. Anybody who asserts it is just a pure lie. And, you know, where's the media now talking about fake news? This is all fake news. And fundamentally, the companies that are being built in the last 5 years are more successful, more powerful, higher market caps. So think of like Zoom, like just Zoom's market cap is $130 billion. Tesla's market cap is like whatever, $300-400 billion, let alone the up and coming companies like Square, $60-70 billion company. All these companies have been built in the last decade. Like then there's the private companies that will eventually be public. Think DoorDash, Stripe. All of these are 10, 20, 30, $40 billion companies. So whatever effect is allegedly occurring, it certainly isn't handicapping the ability of an entrepreneur or an immigrant to move to Silicon Valley, start a company from scratch and be one of the top 50 companies, 100 companies on the planet within 10 years. That's on the, just the pure economics, which makes no sense whatsoever that, you know, in these reports.
And quick thing on this, because, you're actually the first venture capital we sort of spoken with. So I definitely think this flew over a decent percent of audiences. I just want to sort of specify something. So when we're talking about Google as a deterrent, and correct me if I'm wrong when I summarize this, basically the idea that the House is putting forth is that, you know, I come in to pitch you on a company, you say, well, look, Google has that market or Facebook has that market, so we're not going to try to compete. We're not going to sort of fund it. That's the dynamic the House is, correct? Is that a good summary of what the argument would be?
Well, the argument in the House report is that it deters innovation and deters venture funding writ large, which is empirically false. And speaking for ourselves at Founders Fund, we'd be perfectly happy to fund people that want to compete with Apple, Google, Facebook, the right entrepreneur, absolutely all day long, you know, call me up. there's absolutely no product or service that we wouldn't fund if the right entrepreneur, you know, had an interesting way of innovating, meaning like that they were going to provide a better value proposition. I mean, certainly if you're going to compete with Google on Maps, you better have a better value proposition on Maps. If you're going to compete on search, you better have a better search engine, you know, in some dimension. If you're going to compete on the basis of Gmail, you better have a better email. Look, in fact, someone already has, like Superhuman, you know, from scratch, Front. These are two email-based companies that are, you know, really dominating actually right now. So fundamentally, I think this is just naive people. I don't know any VC that's, you know, been successful that believes this. Scott Cooper from Andreessen Horowitz recently also critiqued the argument empirically. I saw yesterday. It's just not true. So, you know, people are entitled to their opinions, as lots of people have said, but they're not entitled to their facts.
And the I'm curious about this, though, Keith, which is that the counter I've heard from these folks, I'm not sure if it's about if it's been quashing VC, but that they're saying that you guys are essentially trying to fund companies which will get bought by these behemoths.
Absolutely not.
Ergo, that's just okay. Go. For
that's it. It's the most ridiculous thing ever. It is a complete unmitigated disaster for me as an investor when a company gets acquired. The only time I make money, the only time my LPs or my bosses, my shareholders are happy with me is when a company builds a $10 billion plus company, period. So yes, in theory, if Google wants to spend over $10 billion, maybe I won't be sad, but I truthfully would be sad emotionally. So the only time I'm successful is when I fund somebody from the ground up and they build a public company, period. Mm-hmm.
So
and that's true for any,
so
that's true for every single VC that I compete with. Every single one is only happy when the company they fund turns into be a public company, period. And there's no exception to this. Like, there's nobody I compete with on any day that doesn't want a $10 billion plus public company, and they consider everything below that to be a failure.
So a good way of defining this for the audience then is that, let's say, you know, Sagar and I start the Realignment VC firm. We fund a bunch of companies and they all sell for 20, 30, 40, 50, even $100 million. That would not be a success by the standards of what venture capital is supposed to do, correct?
For any top tier VC, that would get me fired if that was what I was doing every day.
And why is that? Can you explain how, like, I know it's a heady thing, but like what about that is a failure relative to what you are actually, like in terms of like when someone hands you money to invest, like why is selling something for $100 million a failure?
Okay, so let me walk through simple math. So we invest $1.4 billion approximately in a 3-year period of time. And the people who give us that money expect us to produce somewhere between 4 and 8x that. So we need to turn $1.4 billion into, let's say, $10 billion just for simple math. The only way to turn $1.4 billion into $10 billion when we're basically paying, let's say, a valuation on average of about $100 million when we enter a company is to return everything. And this is net of like dilution for employee equity and a bunch of other variables. But fundamentally, we need 7-8x in a 10-year time horizon. So if you invested $100 million, and that's probably being generous, it's probably a higher price on average right now, but if we invested $100 million to get 7, 8, or 9X, that better turn into $1 billion per company. So the only way that works is a lot of companies better be very, very successful or the math just doesn't work. Like, yeah. So in other words, producing an incremental 20% doesn't do me any good because the people who give us money are the most sophisticated institutions on the planet. Think the endowment of Harvard, Stanford, large hospitals, pension funds, extremely sophisticated. And they can take the money that they give to venture and put it in the stock market or buy municipal bonds or buy real estate. And the only reason they give us this money is they expect that we can produce significantly greater total returns than these other assets. And if we can't do that, they'll just take the money away from venture and give it to all the other people in the world that want their money.
Yeah, I think this is something that's very important for a lot of people to understand, just about what it actually looks like, because that is a common conception here in Washington. The other one I want to get to you is kind of from the right critique of Silicon Valley, and it largely focuses in the mainstream right in the idea of a left-wing pervasive bias, which is controlling the commanding heights of American culture. And it's morphed into a market power conversation, basically saying that market power of tech firms enables kind of a left-wing commanding heights of American culture, which can silence a conservative majority. Now, as a conservative person within Silicon Valley yourself, what's your response to that?
So I think there's some truth to that. I believe that most of the Silicon Valley companies are controlled by a left-wing monoculture and that it is implemented in some of their policies and decisions. So for example, I saw, you know, YouTube basically filtering videos based upon what the World Health Organization thinks. And that's insane to me. the World Health Organization has been wrong on every possible topic related to COVID, and using them as the barometer of what acceptable discourse is absolutely irrational. And I really think Congress should hold significant hearings with Sundar and Susan about this policy. Similarly, I saw Twitter yesterday suppressing the tweet of the president about, you know, COVID being the same severity as the flu. He may be wrong or not, and you can debate that. Certainly, you can debate that at certain age groups. But I think suppressing the views of the president of the United States is absolutely crazy. And if it was Joe Biden, I can guarantee you in the Biden administration, Twitter will never suppress a single tweet by the president.
Right.
And so there's clearly a bias there. Now, that said, these are private companies. And as a conservative, you sort of believe in, you know, private enterprise, and, you know, companies should have the power generally to exercise their own discretion without, you know, interference by the government. So you kind of have this weird conflict as a conservative. And we used to talk about, you know, going back a couple of decades when I was growing up as a conservative, you know, the media was basically the gatekeeper that was creating this bias. And the Republican answer, conservative answer to that was not like, let's ban the New York Times, even though it might have been short-term beneficial. It's constitutionally impossible and maybe even unwise. The conservative answer was, well, we created Fox.
Yes.
And, you know, to some extent, the Wall Street Journal op-ed pages, and to some extent, you know, things like the Weekly Standard. So I think sometimes funding, you know, alternatives is a really good idea and a better solution than government regulation from a conservative perspective. That can be done. I don't believe it's easy, but, you know, creating Fox from scratch, many people thought Rupert Murdoch was insane and crazy and that it would never work. So I think sometimes the right answer is to take the risk and build something new that's better and superior versus like suppressing something. But the bias is real. There's no doubt that all of these large tech companies, you know, just look at the political donations. I think someone did analysis recently that showed like 96% or more of, you know, political contributions from Silicon Valley went to Biden. And even more interestingly, I saw a enterprising reporter for Fox showed that actually Silicon Valley is so left-wing that Biden was actually the least favorite candidate of the Democrats. So Biden actually received very little money in the Democratic primaries from Silicon Valley. All the Silicon Valley money was going to the left-wing crazies of like Elizabeth Warren. You know, so like there is a strong bias here that's well off the, you know, median or middle bell curve distribution. But what the right answer from a conservative perspective is not necessarily just to, you know, retaliate with the power, you know, brute force power of the government. So I think it's a fairly complicated topic among conservatives to figure out what to do about it. I don't think ignoring it is a good answer either, but I think creative brainstorming around what is a conservative first principles approach to the bias in Silicon Valley tech companies. But the last thing I'd want to see is like intentional regulation. But to some extent, if there is discrimination, I think there are rules, principles that are generally neutral that could probably be applied and might, you know, yield some course correction. So, for example, to show you how biased like some of these platforms can also be, my husband wrote an article in Foreign Policy. In Foreign Policy, so which is probably the most elite, prestigious, you know, sort of academic-oriented establishment,
yeah,
about some of the threats posed by China. And Twitter actually suppressed the damn policy, the article. Like he tried to, you know, advertise to promote people reading it. And Twitter to this day has still not yet reversed that ban. That's completely insane. So I, you know, talk about China's spies. I'm wondering who at Twitter made these decisions and where did they get their money from? Like, because like the idea that you would actually suppress an article published in Foreign Policy, like start thinking about what that means for the American, you know, American discourse and how much influence China has.
And and for our listeners, we had Jacob on the show, I think it's episode 49. And I read the article Keith is referring to for research purposes. It's very straightforward, good center left stuff, right? There's nothing radical. He's not saying China virus. So I really suggest everyone take a look at this article and see if that's insane, if anything likes to be repressed. So my sort of last question here, and we got into this debate about the right with Joe Lonsdale when we had him on talk. talking about speech. He shares a lot of the same positions with you on this topic. But could you respond to sort of the most doomerist right-wing view that we're sort of running into, which is that they would sort of say, look, Keith, you're talking about how in the 80s and 90s we came up with talk radio and we came up with the Drudge Report. We came up with Fox News. And guess what happened during that period? During that period of time, the right lost 7 out of 8 popular vote elections. Aside from the appointments during the Trump administration, I think you could argue, so with the Supreme Court accepted, like the country continued to move inextricably towards the left socially, economically, those sort of matters, right? It was some of those sort of changes that Trump was able to exploit. For example, him making peace with Medicare and Medicaid, much in the same way that Eisenhower made peace with Social Security in the 1950s. So they would just sort of say, like, look, it's great that you're telling us to build new things, but those new things we built in the past didn't actually work. Now, your whole thing, especially being a VC, is being optimistic about the future. So can you just sort of offer the optimistic take on the doom I just gave you?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly as a conservative, many things you talked about are true and scary. However, I think ultimately conservatives need to take responsibility for the future, their own future, the future of American people, the future of their children. And sometimes it means making better arguments. Sometimes we actually failed, per my point about healthcare. I think the conservatives have absolutely failed in articulating a better vision of healthcare, which does exist, but like it's our fault. To some extent, conservatives, Peter Thiel tried confronting, you know, the dominance in the monopoly position of the American, you know, university system and how insane the ROIs were and the debt and student load 10 years ago. And it wasn't just the left that was criticizing him. So, you know, we should have broken up the monopoly of colleges and universities in the United States, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And now, you know, some of the disadvantages are becoming obvious to everybody. It's just, I think we bear responsibility for framing things, articulating the right facts. So, for example, Trump was a miserable failure in the debate against Biden. He had the, you know, audience of 60 million American people, and he probably made 1 or 2 coherent comments in an hour and a half. And that's just not only embarrassing, but it's a lost opportunity to persuade people that there are better answers, better solutions than this left-wing nonsense. The good thing about left-wing politicians, though, is some of them are actually pretty proficient at framing arguments. Ted Kennedy back in the day was a master. If you read his 1980, you know, concession speech at the Democratic National Convention, might be the single best, you know, speech by an American politician in my lifetime. You know, AOC definitely knows how to use social media. Why aren't Republicans figuring out how to use social media? Like, there's no reason they can't. I mean, of course, if they did, you know, the media would say social media platforms are undermining our elections. But in any event,
catch 22.
We should at least be trying. Josh Hawley shows some, you know, characteristics. You know, and you can use old school techniques too. Writing books works. People do read books still. Books can seed good ideas. You know, back in the day, Bill Bennett, you know, his book, you know, actually had major influence. So I think sometimes looking at ourselves in the mirror and saying, how do we do our jobs better and more successfully is more fruitful than complaining and whining.
Yeah, I think this is where the major cleavage that we have is on the right, which is that the doomers would say, you know, Rupert Murdoch couldn't make Fox News today because nobody would advertise on it, right? In 1996, their blue chip companies didn't mind trying to reach conservative voters. In the age of Nike, Colin Kaepernick, and all of that, with the forces of capital essentially either arrayed against you or can
neutral.
Be shamed. Yeah, or at least, you know, when the forces of capital were neutral, it was fine. But now with the force of capital aligned against you or able to be shamed away from you, I mean, doesn't that take away your power to exercise yourself as a free citizen? I'm just talking in terms of the way that a lot of people think, and I'm quite sympathetic.
Perhaps. I think there's some truth to that. But then on the other hand, there'll be some enterprising entrepreneur who says, you know what, if I advertise on this right-wing network, I can actually sell some goods and services. And I'm going to actually build, you know, a market cap from scratch because I'm actually immune from this stuff. So it gives opportunities for people who want to compete with the next Nike. That's one. Second, I think there's a decentralization option, which is fundamentally allowing people to subscribe to things, I think is the root answer. Just like it's been hard to suppress conservative books. You know, the New York Times tries to edit their bestseller list to suppress them, but fundamentally, people buy conservative books. So when people can just choose, consumers can choose and vote with their feet in their pockets to subscribe to things, you avoid the sort of blackmail at the advertising level. So I think we'll have to go to subscriber-based models, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think there's positive economics and sort of lots of reasons why it's maybe even superior anyway to an advertising-based model.
Yeah, part of the prop, what's interesting there though, is that with subscriber, well, the advantage of the advertiser model is that it's open, it's big. Like those are where the numbers are, right? Like the problem with the subscriber model is that, like, for example, I used to read National Review all the time, but they put up a paywall. And to be honest, I already subscribed to 10 other things. So I think there's this funny dynamic what you're talking about, which is that it's valuable from a sort of getting your speech out there perspective to your community that's afraid it's getting targeted, but it's probably not great from a persuasion perspective.
Maybe. I mean, the Wall Street Journal and The Economist are subscriptions, you know, that are very expensive in the grand scheme of things. And I would argue that there may not be any more, any content that has more influence across the globe than The Wall Street Journal and The Economist. Secondly, Netflix is a subscription business. It's probably the most important entertainment company on the planet right now. So I just don't buy this. And then if you look at the micro level in Silicon Valley, the single most influential publication in all of technology is this thing called Stratechery, and it's purely subscription. So I just think across any vertical, the most influential publications or the most interesting and successful organizations are actually becoming subscription, and I think more people need to realize that.
Yeah, I am. I think that's actually a pretty inspiring note to end on. So Keith, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Be sure to share with all your friends. Getting subscribers really helps us, and rate us 5 stars and leave a review of a question if you haven't already.
As always, thank you to our sponsor, the Lincoln Network, for letting us do the work that we do. Check out the upcoming Reboot Conference at reboot2020.org, and we will see you all on Thursday.